Clojure popped up on my radar and I thought, oh, this is pretty cool. And then I explained Clojure and she's like, what's that? We make robots and we use Clojure and we build developer tools.
You need to spend a lot of time learning Lisp, setting up the infrastructure, learning new concepts.
We all just want to build something we're proud of.
If people already did this, that's a good sign.
This is going to help us find the right engineers to build the right product. You know, when you're trying to build a team, Clojure is a painful filter. Clojure, really? What's that? Why not just build it in JavaScript?
How it actually works if you choose Clojure in the startup?
So the reality of leading an engineering team is you're going to have to make a bunch of ugly decisions at times of which corner to cut.
If everything is great, for me, it looks like the full picture of a technology, of anything actually. Clojure really shines with data-oriented programming and data manipulation because it's kind of native.
Should we hang up the Clojure script-based front end and just move to, you know, TypeScript and more widely embraced solutions? Is Clojure dead?
Hey guys, welcome to the 8th episode of our podcast, Clojure in Product. Would you do it again?
And today we're excited to talk with Jeremy Corrado, former CTO at Mobot. Mobot is a cutting-edge QA as a service platform that utilizes real robots to automate mobile device testing.
Jeremy, a Clojure enthusiast since 2016, has driven transformative projects at Mobot, from developing core data models to scaling the team.
Plus, we have a question, best from our previous guest, Nathan Martz. He is a founder and CEO at Red Planet Labs. And his question is, what is the last time you spent all night working on a Clojure project?
So let's begin. Map our questions and macro expand them into real-life Clojure experience.
Hello, Jeremy, and welcome. Thanks for joining us on our 8th episode of Clojure in Product. Would you do it again?
Good to see you guys. Thanks for having me.
To kick off our conversation, Jeremy, you had a really long career in engineering starting from 1997 and have previously held roles such as CTO at Mobot and VP of Technical Operation at Birchbox. So could you please share your journey and how you first encountered Clojure and what is it that actually attracted you to the language?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, I'll start from the beginning, but I'll sort of accelerate to the interesting parts. So I, as you mentioned, I started working in the mid to late 90s, was in college at the time, was a philosophy major, do not have a philosophy degree, dropped out, kind of fell in with a guy with like a one-man computer fix-it biz out of his apartment. It was interesting, but I wasn't super passionate about it. And shortly thereafter, I discovered Linux and free software. I was a Debian package maintainer for a little while, and I just really fell in love with it. Over time, taught myself to program. My first programming language was C, but the first one that ever paid any bills was Perl. That was long ago in the like mod Perl 2 web days. And right off the bat, everybody has to pick an editor. I picked Emacs. And that was really my introduction to Lisp. Still a daily Emacs user, absolutely love it. But I think that's what planted the seeds for me. And as my career progressed and as I spent more and more time programming, I just was always attracted to Lisp and Lisp dialects. Played with Scheme and Racket a bit, Common Lisp, some Emacs Lisp a little bit here and there. I think it was toward the end of my time at Birchbox. I was at Birchbox for 8 years. It's a pretty long time. Towards the end of my time there, I was kind of looking for a new personal project. And I was like, oh, you know, I'd really like to truly learn Lisp. Like I had my copy of SICKP, which is, I can see it from my desk. But it's not something I felt like I really knew well. And it had always had this, you know, allure, right? Like this is true programming. But then I was like, well, how come people aren't using it so much? Like why isn't anybody building big things I've read about? And I just started to research. I'm like, well, where is Lisp today, right? Like, again, at this point, it's sort of like toward the end of my career at Birchbox. I guess it's probably seven, 8 years ago. And in that process, you know, Clojure popped up on my radar. And I thought, oh, this is pretty cool. And just the idea of a JVM-hosted Lisp really appealed to me. I just thought, like, that kind of bridges the gap that I think was missing, right? I'm like, oh, cool, like, now I don't have to wait for people to build every tool I might possibly need. I can access it. And I don't have to contend with, you know, performance issues as much, right? Like that you would think of in something in that paradigm. I was like, oh no, I mean, people have invested, you know, billions of hours into optimizing the JVM. It seemed kind of like the best of all worlds. So I was just really attracted to it. And then I started playing with the language and teaching myself very slowly. It was a bit of a learning curve. As I said, I already had, you know, a bit of a background in Lisp, but still, you know, there was definitely a little bit of work for me personally to come up that closure curve. It was also right as our first child was being born. So maybe it was a little sleep deprived too, but I just remember those early days really enjoying getting little bits of time to sit down and play with the language. And there are just, you know, a number of really well-written books out there that I just really enjoyed getting to get my teeth around it. As I was transitioning out of Birchbox, I was very lucky. My last year there, I was kind of on a partial schedule. And so I looked for an open source project to contribute to, and I found YetiBot, which is a really fun little project. It's run by a guy named Trevor Hartman, who's just a great human and a great engineer and just really a good community builder. So that was a great experience to get to build something useful, learn from people with more experience, do a little bit of mentoring of people who are coming up with even less experience than me. And yeah, that was my introduction to Clojure. And then once I finally left Birchbox and I was thinking, well, where am I going to go next? A real big thing for me, there were two big career motivators for me at that point. One was that I had been a VP of technical operations. I had been a systems architect. I had done a lot of professional programming, but I'd always sort of worn two hats of like systems side and software engineering side. And I really wanted to move out of like VP tech ops into more general VP of engineering. So my career goals out of Birchbox were to find some place that would let me take on the wider challenge of all of engineering. And then the cherry on top would be if I could get into like a 0-day project, you know, somebody's like total greenfield early startup and convince them that we should build it on Clojure. It's like, that would just be the best thing ever. And I held out for a little while and I found a really awesome lady who had just come out of Y Combinator, and she had this fun, interesting idea of building a set of mechanical robots to do testing of mobile apps. And I thought, wow, this is really well suited to Clojure. Like one way to characterize testing as a state management problem, you know, like control things and then change some and see, you know, assess the delta. And the other is it's just a big concurrency problem, right? Like orchestrating a whole bunch of robots. And I'm like, what do I know that's really good at state management and concurrency? And then I explained Clojure and she's like, what's that? After a few conversations, she bought in, and I guess the rest is minor personal history. That kind of brings you up to today.
We will be talking a lot about your experience at Mobot, as it's an interesting case when you started up a Clojure project literally from scratch. If you could summarize what Mobot does actually in a few sentences, can you please share it?
Absolutely. So if you are building a mobile application, you, as is the case with any software product, should test it. If you want to test it, there are a lot of really good ways to test mobile apps. There are great virtualization platforms for both of the dominant OS families, iOS and Android. And you should absolutely leverage those tools. Depending on your application, those could get you all the way. But they could maybe only get you 85% of the way. And depending on the criticality of that 15 or whatever percent, you will probably find yourself doing some manual testing. It's a bit of the dirty secret of the mobile industry that there's just a lot of manual testing that still goes on. My founder was a PM, and she had a pretty mature mobile application, and she had a desk full of mobile devices. And for every release, she was still poking away on 15 different phones just to make sure, even though they had a really replete test suite and it was, you know, well-conceived engineering, good release pipeline. So she's like, isn't there a better way? Let's build some robots to do it. And then that is how Mobot was born.
You mentioned one step back that you had a conversation with the CEO about Clojure. And I'm curious, what did you say actually about Clojure? Or how do you sell it?
Sure. So this is my whole thesis on teams and language selection and tooling. And it may be a little divergent, which is not to suggest that the typical arguments people make about the fitness of a language for a particular task isn't critical. I think it absolutely is. I adore Clojure because it is a fantastic way to solve programming challenges. But that is not how I actually managed to get it over the line with my founder, and it is not actually what I would characterize as its greatest superpower. She asked me, she's like, "What? How do we build an engineering team? What do software mm-hmm. engineers want? What makes engineers happy? Like, what motivates them? How do we keep them? How do we find them?" And I was like, "Oh, engineers are super duper simple." She's like, "What do you mean?" I'm like, no, we're very simple. We all just want to build something we're proud of, right? Like, we want to build something where we look at it and we're like, that's the best I was able to produce right then with those constraints, that time, those resources. This is the highest quality outcome I could produce. Like, we just want to build things we're proud of. So what I think Clojure's superpower is, it's a fantastic tool. It's a great ecosystem. It's a great community. But it just attracts a quality of engineer that I want as my colleague. And the thing is, software is, at least for the foreseeable future until LLMs totally take over, it is built by people. And I find that when building a team, building a new product, you're thinking about the software architecture for sure. You're thinking about the tooling, mm-hmm. but just finding the right people mm-hmm. is really what it boils down to. We're a relatively small shop, 15 engineers. Most of those were very senior people. Most of those were people who had a lot of Clojure experience. Mm-hmm. But two of the people we hired had never even heard of Clojure. But I just knew that they were the cut from the right cloth and that they were just the right kind of people you wanted as a colleague and they could learn. So the way I got Clojure over the line with my founder, one, she and I just had a good rapport and she trusted my technical mm-hmm. call. And I said, this is the right language. And then I made a bunch of arguments about concision, efficiency, density of defects, you know, all the stuff people mm-hmm. normally say. But the main thing is I just explained that this is going to help us find the right engineers to build the right product. I will also note, we had the advantage of being tasked with building a product that really benefited from a high level of quality. And what I mean by that is not every solution needs to be solved with top quality mm-hmm. engineering. I mean, the reality of it is, as a professional software engineer, you are tasked with delivering a solution within a set of constraints.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that everything you ever build has to be the highest quality. And that's a bummer. None of us like that, right? We mm-hmm. all hate that. But that's the reality of it. When you're building testing tools, when you're building infrastructure, when you're building things for other engineers, you can justify a higher level of polish. Mm-hmm. It was actually one of the things I was very intentional about seeking out as I left Birchbox, which was e-commerce, beauty in a box. Yeah. It didn't require top quality engineering. It required mm-hmm. really thoughtful engineering, and it was a great team. That team was always, I thought, punching below their weight almost, like they were more talented than what we had to ship. But I specifically wanted to work someplace where I could justify really high quality engineering. So with that in mind, you can bring in something like Clojure. You can lean into a team model where you're going to be paying for and staffing more senior people because you're going to be producing something of the appropriate mm-hmm. level of quality. But I still thought it was a good idea to mix in more junior people just for the fitness of the team and, you know, just team culture. So it was pretty easy to get it over the line with my founder and explaining to her, you know, like, hey, this is the right quality of engineering. But really, I think it was just, this is going to help us find the right engineers to build mm-hmm. the team, the company, the culture that we want. Because it's a very engineering first company. I joke with people all the time that, you know, when you're trying to build a team, Clojure is a painful filter. You're going to find 10,000 more mm-hmm. JavaScript engineers, but it's a great selector. You know, the 10 engineers you're going to find, they're probably 10 engineers you want to work with. It's almost nobody's first language. And the people who come to it generally bring their own steam. They're people who are curious and excited mm-hmm. and people who appreciate the elegance that a language like that allows you to embrace. So I thought it was a really good choice. It worked well for us. And we also were very lucky. We got to build a very complex backend. Mm-hmm. We decided to build a whole front end in Clojure Script. We had a mobile app that we built, Clojure Script Expo. And we also had a pretty complicated sort of like middle service tier, a lot of independent daemons that we built for doing things like packet captures and log aggregation. And mm-hmm. so there's a lot of fun engineering opportunity in there, and Clojure really overlaid well with pretty much all of it.
Yeah, I heard this idea about Clojure as a filter. Basically, it makes hiring process easier, I think. Because if you have a Clojure engineer, for some degree, it should be good engineer because you need to spend a lot of time learning Lisp, setting up the infrastructure, learning new concepts and such kind of things. And if people already did this, that's a good sign.
Plus, they're so excited to work with Clojure. You know, we were lucky, right? We were like, we make robots and we use Clojure and we build developer tools. Like, we were not short on people who thought it was a fun project to work on. But yeah, you're absolutely right. It brings in just great developers, great engineers.
Yeah, I just want to say that it's funny you mentioned this terminology filter. I just want to say to our audience, we haven't asked you to say it, because you're like the first person on our podcast who said the same thing, that Clojure acts as a nature filter for engineers.
And did you have any alternatives if we speak about languages when you started this project?
Yeah, I will say I am fundamentally a back-end engineer. I have been my entire life. I always joke with people, if you want me to build the front end, it's going to be gray and left justified. I'm just not the one, which is not to suggest that I don't love a really high quality interface. I absolutely do. Just the feel of tools really matters to me. I just know that that's not my special power, not my secret skill. I also have an ops background and, you know, and a hardware background. So I've just always been a back end person. So there was really no question that we were going to build, you know, like the control plane, the service tier, the back of the front end. There was no question. That was always going to be Clojure. Came in and, you know, the bee was in my bonnet. I did not know how we were going to build the front end. And in the early days of Mobot, we really didn't have much of a front end. We had a very lightweight reporting layer. And it was server side, you know, we used Luminous as the, you know, framework initially. We had a Python desktop app using Tkinter. I don't know if any of you know TK and the old TK days. Just because we were initially directly connecting the robots over a serial bus, you know, just USB onto a laptop to do this stuff. In later days, we pulled that into a Raspberry Pi, and that became the high-level controller of the bots. The bots have always been stateless, and that was all Python. It was all stepper motor interconnect. So there wasn't a ton of a front end in the very, 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 very early days. We're talking the early days, like the first 6 months and a bunch of us standing around a WeWork. And then the first engineer that I hired was a friend and former colleague from the Birchbox days, a guy I'd worked with for many years, brilliant engineer, just a guy I've always, and just an awesome human. And so he was the first guy I brought in, and his name is Luis. I was like, Luis, what are we going to build a front end in? I guess JavaScript, right? And I don't know JavaScript. And I'm famous amongst my friends and colleagues as being kind of a JavaScript hater. And I feel like I maybe should be more informed before I put that on my resume, but I don't know. It's just an ugly little language. And anytime people show you weird JS anti-patterns, I always look at it and think, well, that smells funny. But whatever, it's super useful. It's out there. I assumed we were going to just, you know, build a React app or whatever. He's like, no, we should use Clojure Script. And I was like, man, I want to buy into this. I really do. I'd read about Transit, you know, and I was excited at the prospect. I like spec. I like the idea of being able to have a common description for the data as it moved through our system front to back. But he was one who convinced me to Clojure Script. And his whole thing is that, and he made a really strong point, you know, we had been watching, you know, like this rising tide of functional idioms in the front end, you know, people had just paid enough, I guess, enough pounds of flesh to callbacks and just nasty nets. And he's like, no, there's enough people who are going to get the idea. We could definitely use Clojure Script on the front end. And that's what we did, and absolutely no regrets on that. It's been great. I think some of the promises of Clojure Script, it delivered. I think it delivered a little different than I was expecting. So, you know, we can unpack that in time if you want. So I was dead set from the beginning. We were going to use Clojure on the back end. There was no other alternative option for the front end. I was like, meh, I'll wait till my first hire, who is much more knowledgeable here and much more opinionated. I just presumed it would be JS and, you know, TypeScript and stuff. And he's like, nope, let's go Clojure Script. And no regrets. Really glad we did. As a matter of fact, one of the most talented Clojure engineers I know, again, another colleague over at Mobot, just another brilliant dude. He once described Clojure Script as Clojure's killer app. And I thought that was just a really interesting way to frame it. He's great front to back. But he just had a particular fondness for Clojure Script, and it worked out well. And yeah, as for the service tier, There are actually a few other languages we wound up using in a few places. Like one of the things we do is a lot of the way MoBot represents state is visually, right? The core design of MoBot is this idea of a big directed graph where like there's the device is in a state, you apply some action, this produces another state, right? The vertices are just generally represented as screenshots. To get screens off of devices, you know, we would use ADB on Android where it made sense. We would use AirPlay. So in some of the screen acquisition stuff, we wound up using C++ just because it made sense. But by and large, the rest of our system, the preponderance of the service tier was all closure. Little bit of interop here and there, which we did. We also did a bunch of streaming. You could watch the bots as they were working. So we did a lot of WebRTC stuff. We used some JavaScript componentry, so we did a lot of interop there. We did a lot of Java interop, just talking to different GCP resources. But yeah, no, it was always Clojure. Front end, we moved to Clojure Script. And then I was really not sure what we were going to do for our native app. For our mobile app. I presume we would have gone native. We actually used Clojure Script and Expo. That's actually the only decision that I had more of a management role in that. I wasn't an IC on those projects, but I was more design and oversight. I know the team there after 2 years kind of felt like, maybe we should have gone native. It was relatively small. It's an internal app. We like do a lot of calibration of the phones and we do a lot of screen manipulation. And I think some of the abstractions that the toolchain provided got in the way a little bit, but it was clearly very high quality tooling and I don't want to besmirch it or suggest anything less. Might not have been a perfect fit for our team. But yeah, those would be the language selection choices as they went. And then I said, there's a bunch of Python, all the robot stuff, all the motors, it's all Python.
How do you think, did Clojure Script solve some issues that you would have with JavaScript?
Yeah. So I can't offer as informed a perspective as I can on backend things where I was a primary code contributor, but I can tell you as this is a small and very tight team, we spent a lot of time with upfront design discussions. So I think I can maybe summarize and speak to the trade-offs and understanding my team reached. And these are people whose opinions I would respect. I respect very much. So my big takeaway from Clojure Script in the end was that I don't know that it made us move any faster, you know, from today to tomorrow necessarily, but I think the quality of the product that it produced overall, fewer defects, easier to reason about in your head, greater clarity and subdivision and reusability. I think it was definitely a big net win for us. But if somebody tells you like, hey, write this in Clojure Script, you're going to get it done in a week instead of three, that may or may not be the case. And for us, I don't know that it moved us forward in the early day-to-day faster, but it definitely produced something much more maintainable, which, you know, leads to overall speed for sure. So that was the payoff for us with Clojure Script.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but that was your first project when you decided to use Clojure as a full technical stack.
Yeah, the first paying gig with Clojure. Prior to that, I'd done some open source. I'd done a bunch of personal projects. I'm a tinkerer just by nature. So the first thing I really like built where I like showed it to somebody is when, this is ridiculous. When I was at Birchbox, I remember the VP of, so Birchbox was a very fun place to work. A lot of fun perks. One of the things is we always had just cold brew on tap, like these big casks of cold brew. Everybody loved it. And I remember, you know, people would just queue up in the morning and get that. And after a while, people stopped buying their own coffee and they would just come to the work and they would just drink the free cold brew. But every once in a while, it would be out. And it was just apoplectic, right? Like, where am I going to get my free coffee? I remember the VP of marketing came over to me one day. She was a very cool lady. And she's like, is there any way that the cold brew could just maybe email me in the morning or tweet or something so I know if I should get coffee or not? Which I thought was really kind of a funny request. And that was actually one of the first things that I built in Clojure myself. One of my colleagues was into hardware. And so he used an Arduino. We got a little flow control valve. We tapped into the feeder line on the cold brew cask. And so we were able to like keep a count of how much was in there, right? They would put in a new cask, you would reset it, you would count how much had been distributed. And then you could tell people like when it was getting low. The Arduino, you know, connected over you know, like an RS-232, like a traditional serial interface onto a Pi. And on the Pi is where I ran a little closure daemon that just tracked the capacity of the cold brew cask when it was empty and just would send out emails when it was low. So that was the first thing I ever really built in closure that anyone ever used. I built like a crappy, you know, slide the paddle line break game. Mobot was really the first thing, like a real honest project with other engineers and you know, funding and such.
Maybe you had some you know, challenges that you were expecting when you started using the closure, because you know, it's pretty risky decision to select such niche technology and on the role of I know what was the role when you started work with Mobot. It was VP of engineering role, or it's kind of it was a bit more technical.
Yeah, so I started as the VP of engineering. I was the first full-time hire. There was another lady who was an initial consultant doing some mechatronics engineering. And there was a lady who did some marketing consulting. But I started, and it was Eden, first employee. Eden is my founder, was my founder, first employee. So I started, there was nothing there. So it didn't feel super risky. It felt like a reasonable technical decision, right? Like it was proven robust language, is a rich community. It had all the things we needed, and it sat on the JVM, and you could elegantly go grab the functionality that somebody hadn't produced in a native fashion. So I didn't feel crazy about that. And I knew that we would be able to hire up the people we did. And one of the things that, as an engineering lead in venture capital backed startups, one of the things you are assessed on is hiring. How quickly can you hire the right people? We were consistently able to hit all of our hiring targets in record time. We like consistently beat out the rest of the portfolio companies. We're always able to add the right engineers at the right price point very quickly. Cool. So from the outside, there was definitely always, we definitely had investors ask us like, closure, really? What's that? Why? Why not just build it in JavaScript? And we can talk about why people, you know, hedge those bets. But when they saw that we were consistently releasing features, we were on time, and we were building the team, they were comfortable. They were happy with that. But of course, you know, they always ask you, why don't you just, it's like that old joke, right? Like, nobody ever got fired for building it in Java, right? Like there's always a safe choice. But I think we proved pretty quickly that this was a reasonable one. Really, the main one for me was just once I convinced my founder, and once she offered up that trust and buy-in, I felt like, okay, cool, we have a clear mandate. Let's get building. And then as we were able to ship the features she wanted, everybody was happy.
I see. You know, one of the goals of this podcast is to give other technical leaders who are curious about closure real life perspective, how it's actually works if you choose closure in a startup. And yeah, you mentioned hiring, and that's great that it wasn't a problem to solve this.
It wasn't, but I don't want to suggest that there, because you're right in intimating that there's going to be pushback, there's going to be concern. I mean, I've mostly done startups my whole life, so I can really only speak to that model for funding and the leadership that gates it, right? Like the people to whom you have to answer. And my experience is that you are primarily answering to successful people who have built and exited, right? And so there's a natural confirmation bias that comes with that, right? People are like, hey, I've done this. I know how to do it, right? And I think a very reasonable first blush you get from people is, why not use the most proven and widely tested thing? But my experience was that as we were able to rapidly deliver functionality and that there wasn't a demonstrated deficit to the talent pool, right? Like we were able to quickly add thoughtful engineers producing good quality code. That basically is what got it over the line for us. I think the other thing that benefited us, I feel like as an engineering leader, a big part of your life is technical debt trade-offs. And, you know, I was fortunate enough to have founders and investors who had enough experience to not only assess your daily, weekly, monthly velocity, but rather to understand like, okay, sometimes an engineering team will move at a good clip for 6 months, and then all of a sudden you'll ask them to do something new. And there's this unexpected delay in delivering the new functionality because they have to retool, they have to walk back old decisions, they have to pay down some debt, they have to dig themselves out of some holes, or they painted themselves into a few corners. They need to like, oh, we have to do all of this stuff, and at the end everything's going to work exactly the way that it did, except now we can add that new feature. One of the things we were able to do on our team was basically keep those technical debt trade-offs low enough so that our daily velocity felt fast enough. But we never hit any, hey, we're going to need to redesign this for 6 months before we can deliver a feature. We were able to move pretty consistently. I attribute that to the seniority of the team, good architectural insights going forward, clarity on what we needed to build. We never had to pivot. I think once you get enough of those wins under your belt, like our leadership was pretty senior. And I think after the first year, not seeing any of that, they're like, oh, okay, these guys are, because people stopped asking me like, why didn't you just build in a JavaScript after the first year?
So basically, answer to investors and their questions about technical choice was the results.
Yeah, I think demonstrable results, which, you know, I think it's easier when you're a tiny, when you're the first boots on the ground, right? Like you get a little bit of like, nobody's expect you to show up with a working product, right? Like they give you 6 months to see what you get. And if you can show them something useful quickly, it's, you know, the proof is in the pudding, so to speak. It's one of those things where like once you deliver, they ask fewer and fewer questions. And we never had any sort of a problem where we needed to like go blame the tool chain or the language, right? Like, oh, sorry, I can't do that. Oh,
I see.
You know, like you pick a language maybe that doesn't have strong support for concurrency, and then you have a problem that can really only be solved sensibly with your concurrent design. And then like, oh, shoot, now we got to do, we didn't have any of that, right? It was well suited for what we wanted right out of the gate. But again, it was also just about, it attracted the right engineers. And these were like super motivated, very productive people who were very excited by the problem space. And they just cranked out tons and tons of code and moved it along quickly.
You mentioned it a few times that it was really easy to find the team. However, it started only with you. So as far as I understood, now there are like 15 engineers in the department, but they it's interesting to hear how the team evolved through the years. I mean, at what point you decided that you need this amount of engineering team and then hire a few more engineers? How was it? How was it for you?
It's based on funding. It's when you get a new round of funding, you get some new money. So the way that funding generally works is you have sold some investor on the idea of what you can do if you have the resources. Like, hey, I've done this, I've proven that. Now let's stretch to the next thing. I need you to pour some fuel on the fire. Give us, you know, another $10 million. We'll hire another 10 engineers and we'll deliver this in another 10 months. So it's that kind of thing. So the hiring cadence is generally beholden to the funding. The funding is beholden to, well, you need a great founder who can build those relationships. I spent a lot of time contributing to fundraising, but, you know, I was not the leader. It's a special skill and you need to have a founder who has it. As an engineering leader, you need to be part of a really high quality dog and pony show. You need to get people to buy into the vision. You need to demonstrate it. But yeah, our team growth was always gated by funding, and funding was gated by people buying into the next iteration of the vision's expanse. Yeah. So that's how we were able to sort of stepwise grow the team, right? It was in the very beginning, there were four software engineers. Well, there was one, and then there were four, and then there were 15.
And can you please tell us a bit about actually your responsibilities as a CTO at Mobot?
Sure.
I imagine they evolved through the years. And were you actually coding as a CTO, or you were busy with some other responsibilities and duties?
Yeah, I can describe my role over the years. I feel like roles, like we're all familiar with those titles, right? VP of Engineering, CTO. I think they're expressed in radically different ways at different orgs, depending on the character of the org, the problem their business tackles, the size of the company, right? Like there are plenty of CTOs out there who are boardroom CTOs. They're executives. They're not engineers. They are executives who are tasked with advancing the company, and the oar they are given in, you know, moving the boat forward happens to be engineering. That is not at all what it's like, I think, oftentimes in small startups. I've been through a bunch of startups, and I've been fortunate that my CTOs every time were super technical people. The lady who was CTO at Birchbox, just brilliant computer scientist. Before I was at Birchbox, I was at Meetup. Greg, the guy who was the CTO over at Meetup, just engineer through and through. So I think on tech startups, there's a lot of times that, you know, the CTO is really an engineer who just sort of snuck into the, you know, the monthly board meeting. That was me. So my role, first real FTE, boots on the ground. I was there to just write code. And I basically, day in and day out, just was sitting there. I would talk to my founder. We would go over the vision, like, what are we building? What is the character of our solution to this problem? How do we think about testing? How do we think about a mechanical fleet to automate the gaps in virtualized testing? You know, I still have all my early notebooks, which I recently went back through to read, like the design work. And you just sort of come up with an idea and you just start coding. You make those early decisions. We're going to shove this into a graph database. Nope. We're going to make it square and shove it into Postgres. Okay. Are we going to, you know, how are we going to, you know, host the application, right? You make all your early decisions. And I spent the first 2 years, I would say, just doing design and coding day in and day out, grinding and grinding and grinding. And we had four engineers, then six engineers, you know, the first couple of years. So my role in the very, very early days was, you know, I was primarily contributing code, designing stuff, doing some team building, doing some culture. But, you know, those early days, we were 20 people company, then the company grew to 30 people and go from there. As we got bigger and bigger, and my role was always VP of engineering, I came in as VP of eight. We kept the engineering team mostly flat by choice. In time, as we got, you know, larger still, we began to introduce a bit of an intermediate tier of managers, but all of the people on Eng, they were all ICs who really wanted to have their fingers in the code. I actually think that my success, to whatever degree I can claim to have had any success as an engineering lead, is really largely born of the fact that I am just fundamentally an engineer and I like writing code and I like building stuff. I think that, so the reality of leading an engineering team is you're going to have to make a bunch of ugly decisions at times of which corner to cut. And if you are an engineering lead who is still very hands-on, if your team respects you, you are going to be able to sell those compromises, right? Mm-hmm. Because they're going to be like, okay, this guy gets it, right? Like, he doesn't like, you know, stinky code, but he understands sometimes there have to be trade-offs. And honestly, being an IC, you're kind of blessed with the luxury of almost getting to always take the high ground, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's the bummer role of the engineering lead who has to decide where to cut a corner. So I've always liked being very much an individual contributor. And even in my leadership roles, I was always an IC. Even if I was focused on architecture and team growth and, you know, and stakeholder management, I was still always having a lot of my time where I was directly involved in design discussions, directly involved, you know, grab a few tickets, write some code, you know, do code reviews and then put up code to be reviewed. So I've always been very hands-on. I've also never worked in any place with more than 300 people. So take it for what it's worth. And then in time, I transitioned out of VPOE to CTO. I did that because it just felt like something I really wanted to accomplish professionally. I don't know that I ever need to be a CTO again. It was great. I'm very proud to have accomplished that. It was a lot of work to get there. It was not something that my founder or my board were just going to give out. It was something I really had to earn. But was my day-to-day truly different? It was, in the sense that you have to sit down with your organization and decide what CTO means to your shop. And what we decided it meant for us was that we would begin to bifurcate the leadership of engineering, and we would have more of a day-to-day engineering lead. And then CTO would get to be a bit more future focused, a bit more exploratory. I was very, very, very fortunate that I was able to hire a dude that I had worked with at two prior startups, my friend Dave. So Dave joined Mobot. It was our third startup together. When he joined Mobot, we had already been friends for 16 years. We worked together at the Electric Sheep, which was like a virtual reality gaming Second Life weird fun startup way back when. Dave was always just a fantastic engineer. When we worked at Birchbox, he was always like my go-to guy when there was a real big problem. I would take the operation side, he'd take the soft edge side. And then he transitioned into a bit of more of a management role he just really liked it. And the universe is blessed with those rare software engineers who really decide they want to be great people managers. And he was one of them. And so I scooped him up as quick as I could over to Mobot. And so then as I grew into the CTO role, I got to pull away a little bit more from the daily operations. Mm-hmm. He rose as head of engineering to take over daily ops. So he's the guy at that point who's, you know, doing, you know, grooming a backlog and running sprint planning meetings. And I'm doing more of the like architecture and design meetings, which are the things I like. And I think where I can make a more useful contribution. So that's what CTO meant to our org. And then of course it's talking to the board and talking to investors and all of that kind of, you know, stakeholder management stuff.
The whole story that you told looks very, very smooth. So it looks like you didn't have any challenges, any problems. There was no problem with hiring. Everything with technical stack was great. But for me, it's really important to cover not only benefits and good sides of a technology. And I always want to know what real limitations, drawbacks can exist actually in the platform. Because if everything is great, for me, it looks like, the full picture of a technology, of anything, actually. I'm curious to hear maybe some challenges or drawbacks that you faced.
Yeah, I mean, there are certainly lots of bumps. I just think they were mostly my fault and not closures. I can speak to a lot of bumps, but they're going to be more like the bumps I experienced as an engineering lead in a startup. I don't know that I would point to closure as having a particular role in that. I led a team that lived through the biggest engineering hype of my life, right? Like the big, like, hey, where's AI in our product kind of a thing. One of the challenges that, you know, I have faced over the years as an engineering lead, there would really be two big ones that come to mind. One is that I once inherited a product with a tremendous amount of technical debt. Mm-hmm. And the other would be that in my time at Mobot, I think there was quite appropriately, and I don't want to suggest to the contrary, quite appropriately, a lot of pressure like, hey, are we keeping up with the tide of, you know, AI and ML solutions? So there were a lot of those types of things like, hey, are you guys making the right choices in terms of a product roadmap? Mm-hmm. So there was always plenty of friction and pressure and scrambling there. One of the first things I was tasked with as I moved into my CTO role was to explore like, hey, could we bring AI to bear on some of our more complicated image analysis problems? So that was a fun project.
How you assess the usage of Clojure in area of AI and all these libraries that are available for Python?
Yeah, so the AI project we did was in Python, as it were, right? We used fast AI. I myself have no experience with machine learning projects in Clojure. Certainly, I'm no expert on AI and ML, but my experience having built a useful tool in our org that did what we needed it to do, which was advance and improve the efficiency of the way we assessed images from baselines to actuals as tests were progressing. My experience there was that a tremendous amount of the efficacy of the models we built was a product of the data we shoved into them, less so than model parameters or tuning or training, right? Like that, those processes were pretty well understood. We were able to use a lot of off-the-shelf stuff, and without a tremendous amount of effort, we were able to deliver pretty high quality results. Mm-hmm. But that the biggest factor for us was the data we shoved into it, and all the data we shoved into it moved through Clojure-based systems. So in that sense, they were very central to it. I think our ability to just generate tons of input data effectively through the success of the product more generally would speak to the way those projects progressed and the success they met. But I didn't do any like direct training with Clojure as the overarching harness or anything like that.
The data aspect is not always covered in success of the models that we've created. And Python is not the best tool sometimes for gather the initial information.
No, we at Mobot, we ran tests, right? We ran tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of them daily, right? Actions. There's just a tremendous amount of data generated in that process. Mm-hmm. There's device logs coming, right? Mm-hmm. There's all the screenshots we're capturing. Mm-hmm. And a big part of what we did was also, like, we own the device under test. We own the whole network egress path. We mm-hmm. were able to do transparent TLS decoding to intercept the communication mm-hmm. between your application and your backend, right? Yeah. Basically a man in the middle, but with the blessings mm-hmm. of everyone involved, right? So we were generating tons and tons of data. How you do all of that capturing of that intermediate data, that's really where Clojure shined for yeah. us, right? Like take something like doing like network telemetry, right? There's obviously a lot of infrastructure involved in that of just routing traffic the right way, egressing through the right points, having that visibility to intercept. But in the final analysis, you wind up with tons and tons of PCAP streams being generated by daemons sitting on routers or, you know, mm-hmm. multi-home hosts that we were using as routers. And we were using Clojure daemons to like read a bunch of PCAP sockets, you know, like decode those packet traces, group them by source IP, mm-hmm. chunk them, shove them up into GCS, throw a message onto an event bus so that a downstream processor could work on it. That level of like efficient processing of lots of concurrent inputs, that's really where Clojure was just a huge, huge lever for us. Like there wasn't really an easy way to do that. In my experience with something like Python, we weren't going to do that effectively with Python. Mm-hmm. Right? Like the Clojure and the JVM support for concurrency, its performance, stuff like that, we really leaned into it. It really did well for us. We were aggregating, you know, millions and millions of lines of log mm-hmm. data every day from, you know, hundreds and hundreds of phones on robots, all Clojure daemons that we were running in various places around our network to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Clojure really shines with data-oriented programming and data manipulation because it's kind of native. You don't need yeah. to think about, for example, from Java, about data transfer objects, getters, setters, all this stuff just to manipulate the data. Sometimes I see from my prior experience, because we're doing consultancy for different Clojure projects, and sometimes I can see that power that Clojure gives to developer creates some very over-engineered, strange solutions like macro-based, domain-specific languages, and such kind of stuff. Have you faced these kind of situations in your practice?
Yeah, for sure. I don't think I would limit that specifically to Clojure, though I do mm-hmm. agree with the connection you're making that the power almost makes it an easier mistake to mm-hmm. to make. I'll give you my sort of generic-y, but I think honest answer, which is that over-engineering, under-engineering, bad engineering, I think that it really all comes back to like, what is your team's culture in mm-hmm. terms of design discussions? Mm-hmm. I remember a long time ago, I worked at a shop and we had a standing weekly meeting called the design review. Mm-hmm. And basically what happened is people would work on stuff. They would bring it to design review. They would share it. People would critique it. And then people would get grumpy because they're like, well, I already built it. Don't dunk on the thing I already built. So when I was establishing the design culture at Mobot, I was like, let's call it design discussion and let's mm-hmm. do it before you go write a ton mm-hmm. of code, right? Because people, once it's a precious thing that you've already built, they don't want to let go with it. So to the question of over-engineering and the power that Clojure gives, for sure. But I think if you have a culture where you are reviewing designs collectively early on, mm-hmm. where you have a good code review culture, you can keep people honest. Also, as an engineering lead, I knew who on my team was going to be quick and dirty and who was going to be mm-hmm. the one to introduce like three layers deep of needless uh-huh. abstraction. It's funny. I was actually just writing some code yesterday, a little toy project. And at the end of the day, I sat down and I looked at it and I'm like, why am I abstracting this one thing? There's only one of them. Like, mm-hmm. I understand over here, I have six things that kind of are the same. So there's an abstraction in front of it. Over here, I've got one. And you know what? There's never going to be a second one. Mm-hmm. And so if there's not a rigorous review process, I think anybody can fall into that. And then, yes, there's always the dude on your team who wants to write a bunch of macros. And there are very few, in my humble experience, there are very few places where I have found that the benefit of that has outweighed the cost. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really just, you know, review a bunch.
Actually, you are not the first one who told about the importance of decision-making culture and the process. Other teams use pre-mortems
and all this voting, you can hear in other episodes, and it's pretty interesting to hear what the differences. But they all come to the same. It's collective discussion beforehand, usually. About decision. Absolutely. The next very important question for me, also from our experience of doing consultancy, we sometimes see push from Clojure to more mainstream languages like TypeScript, like JavaScript. Especially this is connected to the front-end tasks. And I very curious to hear your story about maybe you had this internal push or external push from investors to switch the stack to more, I don't know, more popular.
Yeah, for sure. I can recall specifically after our Series A funding, when we were doing a big hiring push, we asked ourselves the question, we're like, okay, is now the time, like Clojure on the back end was a clear, clear path for us. But we did at that point ask, we're like, okay, we're at a fork in the road. Should we hang up the Clojure script-based front end and just move to, you know, TypeScript and more widely embraced solutions? We sat down and had a very careful week of reckoning where we weighed the benefits and costs for us. And we decided it was worth sticking with for us. I think it's going to be a very personal choice for each team. At that point, we had worked with it for 2 years and already had the perspective that even if it didn't add tremendous day-to-day velocity, it just produced a clearer, more coherent product that was easier to reason about, lower defect rate, easier to extend. People were more comfortable with it. And given that we had had no trouble finding engineers to add to the team, we weren't really wooed by the ubiquity of the talent pool in JavaScript. Also, you know, we had been very happy with the level of sophistication and quality of the engineers that we had had and quality over quantity. Not trying to besmirch JavaScript engineers. I mean, there's tons of brilliant ones. It's just our experience was that, sure, there's tons and tons more, but we have been very happy with the Clojure engineers we have and the transition to Clojure Script. We also had a couple of people join our team who were established Clojurians, but had no real Clojure Script experience, and they made the move to that easily. So we didn't see any of the hurdles, and we'd seen a lot of the upsides to it. But for sure, you definitely have investors who are like, why aren't you just going to build it in JavaScript like everybody else? But at that point in Series A, we had had this track record to point to. And
sometimes I noticed the situation that most of the Clojurians that I've interviewed, they really like backend work. And sometimes it's hard to find people that are Clojurians, and they also have experience with React.js, with CSS, with all such front-end work. Maybe you faced some similar situation.
I think I kind of got lucky. As I said, the first guy I brought on was an old friend and former colleague, and he had a lot of Clojure script experience. My first experience, you know, working on a project with Clojure script, one, I didn't do any of the Clojure script myself. He did. I got to just do backend. He did front end. And then when we had our next big push of hiring, we basically, it was about 40% of the people we brought on had Clojure script experience right out of the gate. And then, you know, the rest sort of filled it in as they were curious. We had one or two people who had no interest in moving to Clojure Script. We also had one person who came, she joined our team as a front-end engineer, but no Clojure experience. She learned Clojure. She did a year of working on the back end, and she said, I have no interest in the back end. I just want to be the front end. So people, you know, their proclivities make themselves clear, and you follow that. But we did not have specific experience with the challenge of people moving front to back as they were inclined.
I see. I see.
I will say, though, I have not done any Clojure script. And so it looks opaque and challenging. I don't know. I'm trying to find a a potential wart. It looks tricky to me. So maybe it'd be hard for me. But for the rest of the people on my team, it was not hard. They had very good comfort with it.
Glad to hear that, you know, there was not a big problem. Can you assess the current state of Clojure ecosystem? Do you like the direction where Clojure is moving? Clojure script, the whole tool set, maybe you dislike something.
Yeah. I think the first thing I would say is that I don't know that I'm the most well qualified to opine there. Like, mm-hmm. you know, there are people who are very much have their finger on the pulse of where mm-hmm. community is going, what's new, what comes out. I'm not that person. I just mm-hmm. have never really been. I mean, I periodically pop into, you know, Clojure.org and check out the news and mm-hmm. like read a few links and follow stuff. But I'm not super up on it. But as I was thinking about that, I almost feel like that speaks to Clojure's strength, right? Like I remember working in, you know, Ruby, Python, mm-hmm. if you would need a lib and you'd go and you like, ooh, nobody's touched this in 18 months. That makes me nervous. Yeah, whereas like in Clojure, you'll go and you'll find something that no one's touched in 2 years. And you're like, I guess it just works really well. Mm-hmm. I guess like it does its one thing and you know, everybody's happy with it.
Agreed.
So I don't have a really informed perspective on the mm-hmm. ecosystem, but I will say that I don't have any concerns about the fitness for Clojure as mm-hmm. a tool to solve problems going forward. No misgivings about that. And anytime there is a big new thing that comes out that I am following, right? Like when, you know, core async and spec and everything, anytime stuff like that comes out, I'm like, yeah, this is a great community of smart people. And I'm really, mm-hmm. really excited about the new things they're building that I get to use. So it's been positive in that sense. Every once in a while, you know, you'll see somebody like, you know, like is Clojure dead? I don't know how one assesses that. I mean, there are various metrics out there of like, hiring and code base and this and that, but you have some very large players with very deep pockets that are, you know, building mm-hmm. that are fully bought in. So, I mean, I suspect it's the same thing that, you know, the Haskell and OCaml communities all deal with, right? Like people who are passionate about it, but limited deployment, but a few really high end shops where they go. Matter of fact, the guy that I hired first at Mobot, my friend from prior engagements that spoke well of Luis, he actually is the only person to leave our team. And that's because he just got the Haskell bug and he went and now he works for a Haskell shop. I still love him. He's a great human. But yeah, no, I think Clojure is still very fit, mm-hmm. but I may not be the most plugged into the community. I don't have a strong opinion on where things are going. Mm-hmm. I will say like I checked in recently on like the Luminous to Kit transition. Mm-hmm. Because one of the things I've always really liked about Clojure is actually they tend to eschew big, heavy frameworks. For example, I really like the programming language Ruby. It's a nice little language. Mm-hmm. I don't like Rails, and that's mostly just because it's always felt very opaque to me mm-hmm. and unapproachable. I'm somebody who like I need to grok a paradigm, and then I can figure out the way that translates to a particular problem in front of me. Whereas with Rails, I always felt like, I don't know, there's probably some very long snake named method that will do the one weird thing I need to do. And it's all trick ponies. And I wasn't very good at understanding it. In Clojure, we don't have these big monolithic frameworks, right? We just have, you know, like thoughtful aggregations of tools well-suited to a thing put together. And I look at the way Luminous transitioned to Kit, and it seems to me to be a very healthy way to approach things, a very stable and mature way. So I feel like there are a few overarching factors that make me feel very comfortable in embedding on Clojure and the community and the ecosystem of tooling.
And it's rather common that people don't follow the news about Clojure, its ecosystem, but it doesn't, you know, it's not a problem to build a product in Clojure. And personally, me sometimes use libraries that where last commit was 8 years ago. And I'm not afraid to use it because I can see the source code. It just solved the task and basically don't need to change anything there.
They're often compact. So as you say, mm-hmm. you can go evaluate it yourself. The other thing is, you know, when thinking about is Clojure a safe choice, there's always, you know, the Java escape hatch, right? Like that interop is a huge win. And the way that it's bolted in first class, right? It's not like a dirty secret or, mm-hmm. you know, hidden. It's like just very pragmatic, I think.
Imagine that it's 2024 and you know already everything that you know and you need to start a new product. Would you choose a Clojure as a main technical stack for it?
It very much depends on the thing you're asking me to build, right? So if it is just good enough hack and slash 80% engineering, you know, push it out the door, projects mm-hmm. I don't really want to generally work on, but I think there's a ton of them out there and there are a lot of really compelling businesses built around them. Not every problem needs a heavyweight solution, mm-hmm. but if you have a problem that requires good quality engineering, mm-hmm. if you have a problem that can justify the cognitive demands that something like Clojure puts on you, in many ways, it's very freeing, but and maybe I'm just not as bright as the average bear, but it's not the easiest solution, right? Like mm-hmm. imperative strategies are easy, right? Like mm-hmm. get pot, fill with water, turn on heat, add noodles, right? Like it's very easy to work through a recipe, whereas to just have to come up with a way to transform something progressively to yield the intended output. At least for me, it took a little while to establish those, you know, mental pathways. So mm-hmm. Clojure is not always the easiest solution, but like once you've come up that curve, it is very easy to work with things. But I think of it as, is it the right tool for the job? And when you have a large, complicated system, having paid the price for the required rigor of building a solution that is like more considered transformation as versus just mm-hmm. this disparate set of mutations, it pays off in the long term. So to answer your question, would I use Clojure again? It depends on the problem, but if mm-hmm. it was a problem that required high quality engineering, it would absolutely be the thing I would reach for. No question.
Thank you. Very, experienced answer. That's... usually the answer sounds like yes, of course. And you also set kind of limitations for the answer. And that's I really appreciate. Okay. Our previous guest, Nathan Martz, he's founder and CEO of Red Planet Labs and creator of RAMA platform. Maybe you heard about it. For sure. And he left a question for you. What the last time you spent all night working on a Clojure project?
Two nights ago. And it was not intentionally. I have some small children and I do not get to stay up all night. I do not get to stay up all night because I often have to be up early because they wake up at the crack of dawn like farmers. Mm-hmm. I can say that I grew up on a farm. So I don't get to stay up all night if I want. But sometimes they wake up in the middle of the night. Somebody needs to go to the bathroom. Somebody's blanket's all fakakta. My wife and I are in basically shift parenting with our youngest who's up all the time. So I had him two nights ago. He woke up in the middle of the night. I finally got him back to sleep. And then I'm laying there and I'm like, I totally can't sleep. What am I going to do? Well, I'm already laying on my couch in the office right next to that kid's bedroom. So I was like, I'm going to get up and I'm going to write some code. And I just sat at my desk for another 2 hours and worked on something for fun. It was delightful. And I didn't regret a moment of it until I had to get up 3 hours later.
Thank you. And what kind of projects are you writing?
It's just a fun like project for learning. I'm actually just re-implementing Tetris just for the funsies of it.
I see.
I don't have much of a graphics background, so I'm just playing with that.
This is the part of the podcast where you can leave your question to the next guest.
Interesting. That was a way more fun question than I was going to come up with. I was going to ask sort of a lame-o question. Now I feel like I could do better.
I have different kind of questions.
Yeah. I'm going to actually stick with my lame-o question. I just like to hear people talk about their experience leading teams where they intentionally hire people who don't know Clojure and teach them. Because I'm just like a real big believer in just hire the right people and they'll find a way to be useful and contribute, you know, just like hire smart, good, thoughtful, kind humans that you want to spend time with and think through hard things with. And if they know Clojure, awesome. If they don't, they'll learn it. Tried to be intentional at Mobot of hiring a few folks who didn't know it. And my question that I would leave for the next person would be, what is it like teaching new people on your team Clojure? Because it was a really fun experience for us. We actually wound up building a standing meeting called Clojure Learning. And it's just once a week, we would all meet and just dig into it just very intentionally. So it was good for us. And I'd be curious to hear people's experience building teams, Clojure teams, when not everybody knows the language up front.
Yeah. Actually, we have such experience in Freshcode. And most of our Clojurian team was not Clojurians.
when they started. So we have a lot of experience of switching people to the closure, selling inside the company, gathering kind of internal courses for them and teaching them closure. Later on, some of them, we start hiring already experienced closure developers, but maybe first 6 or 7 years, it was purely switching from other languages. And it depends on the, I don't know, curiosity of the person. And he's really into programming, can sit all the night. And that's very, very important factor. He's probably will be good in closure because at first it requires some dedication and some efforts to learn the new concepts, especially immutable data structures. And in the past days when people switching from Java, it was really hard to explain. Right now it's more widely spread, the functional programming concepts, mutable data structures, even in JavaScript. But back then it was harder, but they got it maybe in 2 weeks, I don't know, and started doing some real life job. So
yeah, paradigm shift. I mean, I still, I find myself switching back and forth between Clojure and Python a lot for various things. And invariably the first hour I switch back to Python, I'm always like, oh, damn it, sort did not return this sorted. It just changed it in place. I need sorted. And it's just, there's always funny paradigm shifts of getting your head around. So
I'm wondering about your experience of switching from Clojure to Python, because I'm sitting in the one room with an engineer who is actually like kind of switching from Clojure to Python, and he really doesn't like it. He doesn't like programming in Python. So
okay, I'll give you my take on this. I like Python a lot. It's a very nice language. I will never love Python, and I would actually argue that the reason I like it a lot is also the reason that I would never love it. I like it a lot because of its simple character. It's simple, expressive nature. It's very clear. Like, I used to joke with my team, I'm like, everybody kind of knows Python, right? Like, you just sort of look at it and you're like, oh yeah, it says do that and that's doing that thing, you know? It's just, it's very accessible. There's an amazing ecosystem. It makes easy things easy. It makes hard things approachable. But that's also kind of why I don't think I'll ever love it. It has no, to me, and I'm sure I'm going to be lambasted and beaten the next time I run into my Python friends, but it just lacks a certain elegance. Whenever I have been deeply immersed in Clojure programming and then need to go do some Python programming, I always get this sense that everything is just sort of like willy-nilly and loose, and things are just leaking all over the place. And like, I can't keep tabs on it. And I'm like, what the hell's going on? Where'd this go? But I will also say that there are times when I'm like very into my Python groove and I'm just grinding through mutable things, and I'm just slashing and chopping, and I'm moving arrays in place, and I'm incrementing things, and it's like clear and clean and quick and dirty and easy. It doesn't have that same elegance. And while I appreciate that quick, clean, easy, the other side of that is also the lack of assurance and clarity and comfort. So I prefer the paradigms of Clojure and Lisp more generally, but Python's great. So I can understand your friend moving from one to the other and feeling like this feels like a step down. Also, the first time you go to do something with Lambda and you're like, oh, I can only use one expression in here or one statement. You're like, oh, this is anemic. But yeah, such is life.
Jeremy, it's been a pleasure. Basically, we're at the end of the podcast, and thank you very much for today's episode and for joining us. It's been truly an insightful conversation. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you guys for having me. I really enjoyed it very much. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, and to our audience, if you'd like to learn more about Jeremy and his work and about Mobot, we'll be including links below this video. So yeah, please make sure to check them out.
Big thanks to our audience, and see you next time on another episode. And bye-bye.
Yeah, until next time. Thank you.